two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Thank you very much, Rebecca, and welcome to the COVID edition of Words and Movies. I'm your ill co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And
healthy,
thankfully, yes, thankfully I am, knock wood. And today we are wrapping up our loosely connected series of music-related movies. And I have tried to put all these episodes together as if I were Rob from High Fidelity putting together a mixtape. So I hope it comes off that way. And speaking of that, our first episode in this series was about the record store. And for this episode, or movies set in and around a record store. And for this episode, we're going to be talking about movies that deal with, you know, the types of people who go to the record store, the music fan. The two movies we'll be talking about today are from the year 2000, Almost Famous, written and directed by Cameron Crowe, and from the year 2002, 24-Hour Party People, directed by Michael Winterbottom. Both of these movies are period pieces. Almost Famous mostly takes place in 1973, while 24-Hour Party People starts out in 1975 and goes through the rest of the 70s well into the 80s. Also, both of these movies are based on true stories, though, of course, liberties are taken, and we'll get to that when we talk about both of those movies. And finally, both of the fan that are depicted in this movie are folks who actually work in the industry. The main character of Almost Famous at some point becomes a music reporter for Rolling Stone. And if you think Rolling Stone isn't part of the music industry, then you have a lot to learn about the music industry. Let's just put it that way. While the main character, or the character who tells the story of 24-Hour Party People, I should say, owned a record label, although a bit of an unusual record label, as we'll discuss when we get into talking about the film. But first, it's all happening, so Claude's going to give us the plot description for Almost Famous.
Yeah, the first thing we hear in this film is a needle dropping onto a record and the surface noise before the music starts. Now we launch into the opening credits, which are being handwritten as though they're notes being taken by somebody. For most of the film, Patrick Fugit is William Miller, a boy who lives with his mother Elaine, played by Frances McDormand, and his sister Anita, that would be Zooey Deschanel, in San Diego, California. But for now, it's Michael Angarano in the role. William gets along well with his mother and his sister separately, but they don't get along so well with each other. Elaine struggles to keep some sort of control over Anita, who feels that her mother is too overbearing and controlling, and she's probably not wrong in that assessment. Now, William can't figure out why he hasn't developed as much as the other boys in his class, and then he learns Mom skipped him ahead a couple of grades, so all his classmates around him are 13, and he's 11 and horrified to learn it. Anita decides to leave home to become a stewardess in order to escape from her mom, and she uses the Simon and Garfunkel song America to explain her reasons for leaving. After she leaves, William discovers that Anita has left him her record collection. Her collection ends up having a major impact on William. By the time he turns 15 and is a senior in high school, William has turned into Patrick Fugit, and he's become interested in journalism, specifically rock journalism. He's writing for underground newspapers and Cream magazine, edited by one of his idols, famed rock writer Lester Bangs, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. One day, William encounters Lester in San Diego, and the two discuss rock music and journalism. Even though Lester claims the industry is destroying the genre and rock journalism is not a stable thing, he sees a determination in William to succeed and assigns him to interview Black Sabbath, who are set to play at the San Diego Sports Arena. William attempts to get into the arena, but he can't get past the doorman. Standing outside and trying to figure out what to do, he meets a group of girls who call themselves the Band Aids. William is introduced to their leader, Penny Lane, who is played by Kate Hudson. She explains their philosophy of how they're not groupies, but they're there to support the music. The other Band Aids in the group are Alexia Aphrodisia, who is played by Anna Paquin, Sapphire, Carter, who's played by Feruza Balk, and that's Bijou Phillips playing Estrella Star. Spanish pronunciation. Shortly thereafter, William manages to get into the arena where he meets the opening act for the night, and that's the band Stillwater. By speaking to them knowledgeably about their sound and their musical talent, William scores an invite to join them backstage. During this time, William ends up interviewing them, with the bulk of the interviews coming from member Jeff Beebe, who's played by Jason Lee. William ends up watching the concert from side stage as the band opens for Black Sabbath, and we see them performing their song Fever Dog. After the show, lead guitarist Russell Hammond, who's played by Billy Crudup, he invites William to meet them at the Continental Hyatt House in Los Angeles, and tells William that they'd like Penny Lane to come along. William informs Penny, and as they exit the sports arena, she gives him her contact information and tells him of her life's goal. She wants to live in Morocco for a year. A few days later, William sneaks off to LA with Penny, where they meet up with the band at the Hyatt, which they've nicknamed the Riot House. It is here that William, who's already a little smitten, sees there might be some chemistry going on between Russell and Penny. A few days later, William gets a call from Ben Fong Torres of Rolling Stone magazine, who's played by Terry Chen. William has to disguise the fact that he's 15 years old, so he does it by pitching his voice lower. Fong Torres compliments him on his work and asks William about any bands he'd like to cover. So William suggests Stillwater, and soon joins the band on the road, traveling with the Band-Aids on the band's bus Doris, who I believe is playing herself. His mother, of course, is horrified and worried that this will interfere with his schoolwork and derail William's future as a lawyer. At an outdoor stage event, Russell is electrocuted by an ungrounded microphone, sending the band scrambling from the venue, much to the anger of the show's promoter, who's played by Marc Maron. He doesn't seem concerned about Russell's injury. When the promoter has the arena gates locked, the band has their driver crash the bus through them to escape. The band's first t-shirts arrive, and Russell is the only recognizable person in the band because everybody else is out of focus. This launches a huge argument, which underlines some of the problems that have been running in the undercurrent of the band for a while. In short, Russell feels his talent has allowed him to grow beyond the band's limits, and Jeff feels Russell is overshadowing the rest of his bandmates. Russell flees the area with William in tow. They end up at a house party in Topeka, Kansas, where Russell drops acid and climbs up on a garage roof, proclaiming himself to be a golden god. Moments later, he jumps off the roof into a swimming pool. William calls the band manager Dick, who is played by Noah Taylor. Dick comes to the house and convinces Russell to return to the band. Back on the tour bus, the tension between the band members and the entourage is palatable, but they all seem to reconcile as one by one they sing Elton John's Tiny Dancer together. William tells Penny he needs to go home, and she tells him, "You are home." As the tour continues, William is able to interview almost everyone, but still can't get the key interview with Russell. William has to fend off questions from Ben Fong Torres about the story, with some delaying tactics about the nature of the story, and of course, he's also rousing the ire and the worry of his mother, who, during one of her classes, she's a college professor, she proclaims to the class, "Rock stars have kidnapped my son." One night, while he talks to his mother, Russell yoinks the phone away from William and tries to reason with Elaine, who immediately cuts through Russell's charm and lectures him on being more responsible. However, respectfully. Russell, like pretty much everyone else who encounters Elaine, is a little freaked out by the conversation. The record company sends renowned band manager named Dennis Hope, who's played by Jimmy Fallon, to replace Dick. The band is apprehensive, but they ultimately give in to Dennis's plan for the band to make more money, turning them away from their philosophy of playing for the fan. Dennis is also instrumental in adding more tour dates, getting the band some better treatment from concert promoters and stage managers, and the band ditches Doris the tour bus for an airplane. At one of the stops, William is privy to a poker game in which Dick and Russell wager Penny Lane and the Band-Aids in a game without Penny or the girls knowing. The girls have to leave the tour before they arrive in New York because Russell's wife is going to be there to meet the band. The band Humble Pie ends up winning the Band-Aids and pays Dick and Russell $50 and a case of Heineken beer. William tries to put this out of his mind, but upon hearing how Penny seems to have stepped over that line of supporting the band and fallen for Russell, he spills the beans about the bargain that Russell and Dick struck. The news has a devastating effect on Penny, but she covers it up by flipping ask. The news has a devastating effect on Penny, but she covers it up by asking flippantly, "Well, what kind of beer was it?" So the girls do not accompany the band to New York, but upon getting to the hotel where the band is staying, William runs into another Uber fan named Vic, who tells him that Penny Lane is staying at the Plaza Hotel under an assumed name. William then gets a call from Jan Wenner, the chief editor of Rolling Stone, and Fong Torres, telling him that the band is going to be on the cover of their next issue, and he is permitted to share this news with the band. At a restaurant in New York, this news is met with enthusiasm by the band. However, Russell's girlfriend Leslie, who's played by Liz Strauber, she sees Penny in a nearby corner watching Russell. Dick goes over to talk with Penny, who rushes off. William takes off after her and finds her in the Plaza Hotel, where he finds that she has overdosed on Quaaludes that she's been washing down with alcohol. William manages to keep Penny conscious until the doctors get there, and after pumping her stomach to get the pills out, Penny and William go for a walk through Central Park, where she tells William the story behind her real name, which is Lady Goodman, and she proclaims that he now knows all her secrets. After their stroll, William takes Penny to the airport, where she flies home to San Diego. William joins the band on the plane as they fly to a new venue. Everyone questions where William went in the middle of dinner the previous night, but he's reluctant to tell them. Suddenly, the plane is caught on the edge of a storm. It's violently shaking everyone around. Feeling that the plane is going to crash or break up at any moment, everybody starts to reveal secrets. Dennis reveals that he once hit a man with a car and kept on driving. Dick reveals that he took more money than his regular fee, claiming he knows he earned it. Jeff reveals that he slept with Dick's wife after they broke up. Oh, and he also slept with Leslie. Two more in the band reveal that they slept with Dick's wife. Jeff, in a moment of rage at Russell, tells Leslie that Russell has been sleeping with Penny. William, who's finally, like, blows his cool about the way the band has treated Penny, he tells them what happened to her, and he proclaims his love for Penny. Ed Valancourt, that's John Fedovich, who has been silent for some time, comes out of the closet. The weather suddenly clears, and everyone stays silent for the remainder of the trip. And when the plane lands, Russell tells William, write whatever you want. William reports to Rolling Stone's headquarters in San Francisco, armed with his notes, but still without his key interview with Russell. The editors are pretty astonished to see, first, that William is so young, and second, the fact checker is ranting about his notes because they're so disorganized, she's going to have a difficult time doing her job. William asks for a single night to finish the piece, and he calls Lester Bangs for advice, who tells him to be honest and truthful, suggesting that William shouldn't have allowed himself to befriend the band. The story that William writes reveals everything, including Russell's Golden God speech and the airplane confessions. Once the band is contacted by Rolling Stone's fact checker, who, by the way, is played by Erin Foley in her film debut, the band denies 90% of the story, and William is sent back to San Diego, humiliated. At the airport, he runs into his sister, Anita. Anita offers to take William on an adventure to anywhere he wants to go, but the only place he wants to go is home. Anita joins William, and they go to their home, where Anita and Elaine reconcile, and William just crashes into his own bed. Sometime after, as Stillwater is going their separate ways, Band-Aid Sapphire meets up with Russell, and she chastises him for what happened to Penny, as well as his ruining William's story. Nearby, some new groupies are mingling with the band, and Sapphire comments how the new girls are not really fans. They don't love the music. After talking to Sapphire, Russell is compelled to call Penny and apologize, requesting to meet with her. Penny gives him an address, but it is not until he arrives that he realizes she's given him William's address. Russell first meets Elaine, who allows him to talk with her son after telling him sternly that William is a fine young man and a trustworthy friend. Talking with William in his room, Russell explains that he retracted his statement to Rolling Stone and confirmed that the story was true. William then takes the opportunity to get what he never could before, the one-on-one interview with Russell about what he loves about music. Russell eagerly agrees and tells William that, to begin with, everything. The film ends with a montage of different clips that play over Led Zeppelin's Tangerine. Stillwater goes back on tour with their old bus Doris as their main mode of transportation. The tour for 1974 is called No More Planes. Russell and Jeff have reconciled. William is sitting down to a meal with Anita and his mother, who have also apparently reconciled. And finally, we see Penny at an airplane ticket counter fulfilling her decision to go to Morocco. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out a couple of interesting bits in the closing credits. First, even though the Stillwater songs were written by Peter Frampton, Cameron Crowe, and or the Wilson Sisters from Heart, for the most part, Stillwater is credited with performing the songs in the credits, and then the writing credits go to whatever member of the band would have written the song. And the usual disclaimer at the end about this is a work of fiction, etc., notes that Penny Lane is in fact based on a real person, and that most of the other people and events are fictitious. And as the film ends altogether, we hear that needle lifting off the record and the record player shutting off.
All right. Now, this movie is Cameron Crowe's semi-autobiographical story about how he started out as a rock writer, first for a couple underground papers, including one in San Diego, and then eventually for Rolling Stone magazine, although he did not stay there for a very long time. He was there for 5-6 years, I think, although that's probably around the shelf life of many other writers who wrote for the magazine during its heyday. And a couple of a few autobiographical tidbits that he has in there. First of all, the scene in the car where William first learns how old he really is, that is, according to Cameron Crowe anyway, pretty much real to life. He told that story for Premier Magazine when they did a piece on him and the cast of Singles when they were promoting that movie. And while the dialogue that's in the scene, wasn't dialogue that he mentioned completely in the magazine article, one line that I do remember distinctly is Anita. He mentioned that his older sister, who in real life is named Cynthia, his mother's name, by the way, is Alice Marie Crowe, but just as Anita does in the movie, his older sister said to him, "Honey, I know you're expecting adolescence. You're just going to have to shine it on for another year." And then also, one thing that I don't believe you mentioned in the summary is the fact that William, although we only have a hint of it rather than it being shown, loses his virginity to three of the Band-Aids.
Yeah, I omitted that.
Sapphire, Plexia, and another Band-Aid named Beth from Denver, who is played by Olivia Rosewood. And all of that happening, by the way, while the TV show, The Midnight Special, was playing, and Steely Dan was on the program that night. It's funny, the little things you remember about moments like that. And then the plane that he was on that almost crashed, that actually did happen with a couple of different bands, apparently. Alice Cooper has claimed that Crowe was on tour with them and on a plane with them when it ran into some turbulence. And then also, apparently, that happened with him with the Allman Brothers. And speaking of which, the Red Dog is apparently based on a real person. And the group, the roadie that they run into, where William first meets when he goes into the arena with Stillwater, when he meets the band first. And then he's also at the poker game that Penny gets treated like so much Chattel when she's used as a bet in the game. And then also the fact that the Stillwater wouldn't let Rolling Stone use what William had written about them. That is also based on a Allman Brothers related story where Greg Allman and a couple of the other members of the band told Rolling Stone not to use anything Cameron Crowe had written about them. Although in that instance, supposedly they did that as a joke. And then a lot of the people in the movie, although they have their names changed, are based on real people. Penny Lane, as Claude mentioned, the real person's name is Penny Trumbull. Apparently she lives in Oregon now and is still part of the music industry. And about the only people in the movie whose real names are used are the journalists, Lester Bangs, Ben Fong Torres, John Wenner, who is played by Ian Bailey. And although he's never named in the movie, you do see him a couple times in the Rolling Stone office sequences. That's Rainn Wilson, who's best known from The Office, who is playing a Rolling Stone editor slash writer by the name of David Felton. And all of this verisimilitude helped make this movie not only feel authentic, but makes the emotional parts in the movie carry that much more weight, in my opinion.
Yeah, and similarly, the incident where Russell takes the electric shock from the badly grounded microphone, you could trace that to a couple of real life incidents. I don't know if Crow was on hand for either of them, but I know it happened to Ace Frehley in Florida, and it happened to I think it was Keith Richards. It was one of the Rolling Stones at one time. So it's happened more than once in real life, where basically somebody doesn't double check their connections, and all of a sudden somebody gets injured, which is actually the basis of the Van Halen story about the brown M&Ms. And are you aware of this story?
I've heard of it vaguely, but not the complete story.
Okay, so Van Halen, there's a rumor, and it's true, actually, that Van Halen has a rider in their contract that backstage there needs to be a bowl of M&Ms with all of the brown ones removed. And people
Well,
like,
that I knew, just not know why.
Why is that? It's to ensure that the people who are in the venue have actually read the contract through, because when they find the M&Ms, or they don't if they find the M&Ms and the brown ones are still there, or if they don't find the M&Ms, that says to them, they didn't read the contract all the way through. We need to double check everything, because there's a lot of technical information in the contract as far as we need this much electricity, we need this to be set up, blah, 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 blah. And every time that they find that the M&M rider hasn't been fulfilled, something is electrically wrong with the show that has to get fixed before they can go on.
Okay.
So that's, it's basically, it's a trap.
Okay. That's interesting to know. Now, and then, of course, there are the real-life figures who are mentioned, although you can't really tell if it really is him. When they're at the Cleveland Hotel, Stillwater that is, someone's sneaking through, and one of the customers at the hotel who are waiting at the desk screams out, "It's Bowie!" Although it looks more like a David Bowie impersonator than anything else, specifically a Ziggy Stardust impersonator, I guess.
Yeah, I thought it might have been like just a decoy so that Bowie could get in from a different direction. And it was interesting because the person who's like all excited about it being Bowie was the person who was just ragging on Bowie a second earlier.
Right. And then one of the joke that Dennis Hope, played by Jimmy Fallon, says when he's pitching his services to the band is the type of joke I normally am not crazy about, but in this case, it does kind of work when he says to the band, "If you think Mick Jagger is still going to be doing this at the age of 50, you are sadly mistaken. Of course, he's nearly 80 now and still doing it." So, yeah. And then William drops a couple of names as well when he's trying to pitch to Stillwater that, he's not just a reporter, or as they call him, the enemy. He also is an honest-to-goodness fan, and he tells them that it was a good thing that they produced their record themselves instead of having Glyn Johns do it. Glyn Johns is a producer and engineer whose most notable work, I believe, was for The Who. And then, of course, when the band and William and the Band-Aids are at the first hotel on the first stop of the tour they're on, Russell and Jeff are talking about William, and Russell thinks that they can control William because he's a fan, but Jeff tells them, just remember, he's from Rolling Stone, who caused Cream to break up and ripped every Led Zeppelin album ever made. All of which, by the way, is true. Maybe the Cream part, the band I'm talking about, of course, not the magazine. Maybe the Cream part is overstating things a little, because probably the tensions in the band would have caused them to break up anyway. But the Led Zeppelin part is all true. And it's why Cameron Crowe was the only reporter from the magazine that Zeppelin would allow them to interview, because he was the only reporter for the magazine who actually liked their music. And what's also big about Zeppelin and this movie is, except for a brief snippet in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, when one of the characters is playing Kashmir on the car radio as he's driving his date to the restaurant that they're going out to, and you can guess that's probably a mistake on the driver's part, because his friend is giving romantic advice to him, told them to put on side one of Led Zeppelin 4, and Kashmir, of course, is not on Led Zeppelin 4. But anyway, other than that bit, Led Zeppelin was notorious for not letting movie directors use their music in movies. Over the years, they've loosened up a bit on that. David O. Russell has used them in a couple of his movies. The Big Short closed with When the Levees Break, and School of Rock has a very good scene with use of the Immigration Song. But this movie has not only 5 Led Zeppelin songs in it, almost 6. We'll talk about the possibility of the 6 in a little bit, but there's a few bits of Led Zeppelin lore scattered throughout the movie as well. The 5 songs, by the way, in addition to Tangerine, which plays over the last montage, as Claude mentioned, there's also That's Away, which is playing during the bus ride the morning after Russell nearly gets electrocuted. Misty Mountain Hop, which is playing in the limousine when the band and William are driving into New York, and they figure out that William is no longer a virgin, just by the way he grins at them. The Rain Song, which is playing during when Sapphire is telling Russell off for what he did to Penny and what he did to William. And Bronner Stomp, is that how you pronounce it?
It's Bronyor, because there's two Led Zeppelin tracks. One is Bronyor Stomp and one is Bronyor, and it's Bronyor, which is in the film.
Okay, but that's playing when Russell comes up to what he thinks is Penny's house, but ends up being William. And as I said, there's also Led Zeppelin lore that's posted throughout the movie. Claude already mentioned one. When Russell is on acid at the party, he yells out, "I am a golden god," which is something that Robert Plant said when he first saw his picture, or the band's picture, on a billboard in Los Angeles, I believe it was. And then also Sapphire's first line when she comes out of the arena to give everyone passes is, "Does anybody remember laughter?" which is a line that Robert Plant would include in live performances of Stairway to Heaven. And then finally, Vic, the superfan, who tells William that he is where Penny Lane is staying and also what alias she's using. He also shows up at the Riot House very briefly, and he is considered a Led Zeppelin super fan. He's wearing it, and he's talking about how band members touch the pen that they use to autograph his shirt with. And speaking of the shirt, on the front side, it has the lyrics of the Rain song, I believe. And then on the back, it says, "Has anybody seen the bridge?" which is a line, a lyric from the song, The Crunch. And then getting back to Stairway to Heaven, originally, there was a scene where William, along with Anita's, I guess by that time, ex-boyfriend, Daryl, and two officials from the school, one teacher, one counselor from the school. The teacher is, or the guidance counselor is played by Amy Wright, and the teacher, I guess, is played by Cameron Crowe's real-life mother, Alice Marie Crowe. And they have all come to stage an intervention for Elaine to try and convince her to let William go out on the road with Stillwater. And Elaine, of course, is having none of it until William decides to step in and try to prove to her that the rock and roll music that she so despises is not created by people who are on pot, as she puts it at one point in the movie, but actually write about uplifting themes, including the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. And it is true that a couple of Led Zeppelin songs were inspired by the works of Tolkien.
Absolutely.
And so he puts on Stairway to Heaven, and the scene has the song play out in its entirety. And while the band was perfectly willing to let him use the other five songs, they would not allow Crowe to use that song. So it's only available as a deleted scene on the special edition of the DVD, although it's also posted on YouTube, and someone has actually put the audio for Stairway to Heaven on it, because on the DVD edition, special edition DVDs, there's no sound to it at all. Just the scene invites you to queue up Stairway to Heaven to listen to while you're watching that scene.
Yeah, I have to presume, obviously, there'd be a rights issue. And that's kind of interesting. I mean, I know we're going to talk about the music in greater detail, but you know me, when I watch these films, I like to watch with captions on. And one of the things I noticed about this particular film, and when I did this last rewatch, the version that I used was the untitled version, which has the extra scenes in it and makes the film a little bit longer. And
which we're going to talk about in a bit.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I noticed that anytime there was music being used, whether it was a Stillwater song, whether it was you know, diegetic music going on, whether it was background music that was being used, we never got captioning for lyrics, which was kind of interesting to me, because more often than not, you'll get like the little musical note and then the lyric, or it'll be in italics or something like that. And then, you know, so they'll intersperse the music and the dialogue if they need to. But in this particular case, you know, whenever any music was going on, no subtitles whatsoever.
Unfortunately, that's been SOP for a lot of movies, not just Almost Famous. If you watch DVDs that use rock music like that, or even if you watch the movie on TV, they don't always do that anymore.
Yeah,
I think it's sad as well.
Yeah, and well, it's I think it takes away in some scenes. Sometimes it doesn't matter a whole lot, you know. You'd like to at least see where a title where a subtitle comes in, you know, reading something like Elton John's Tiny Dancer plays or something like that. Okay, we're not going to play we're not going to show you the lyrics, but, you know, give the person who can't hear the movie some idea of what's going on, that there is music, you know, being played, even if we have to just see, you know, generic music notes to understand there is music going on. Similarly, One of the other things that they didn't do, and I doubt this is a rights issue. There had to be a creative decision of some kind to do this, is whenever there was inaudible dialogue going on, you did not get a caption saying inaudible dialogue. So there would have been times when somebody who really depended upon the captions would see people like talking to one another. And we as hearing viewers would understand that this is something that you can't really understand what they're saying. But a person who is actually having to read the captions, you know, because they need the captions, would wonder, well, why don't we hear what they're saying?
Okay, I didn't really notice any scenes like that, but okay. A couple things I do want to correct you on, though.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the first time that Russell and Penny start to drop a hint that there's something between them and that William picks up on is not actually at the Riot House. It's when William first goes into the backstage of the San Diego arena, and Penny, we have that great scene where Penny gives him a pass and William says, oh, thanks, I got in with Stillwater. And then she asks him how old he is. And then after that, you know, she says, how old are you? I'm 17. Me too. And he says, actually, I'm 16. Me too. Isn't it strange? The truth just sounds different. And then he adds, ashamedly, I'm 15. And right after that, Russell comes up to them and William introduces them to each other, not knowing that they know each other. And they play along as if they're meeting for the first time, but they shake hands and they hold on to each other's hands for just long enough so that William, as he's looking back and forth at them, realizes that there's something going on here. And as she's driving him, William, that is, to the Riot House, when William actually asks about them, and Penny, of course, denies it, saying, I don't even want to talk about him here. And then the extended cut, and again, I'm going to get to that in just a bit. One of the people she sees in the lobby at the Riot House asked her about Russell as well, and she claims, please, I throw the little ones back. So there is something presented there right from the beginning that there's something going on between the two of them. Also, when William is having that final phone call with Russell, or with Lester, excuse me, what he tells him is be honest and unmerciful, not truthful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue factually, but I think that, like, the first time that William sees, you know, both Russell and Penny together, he doesn't know them very well. So it's just a little bit of a weird moment. And Penny has already, like, demonstrated that she is perfectly willing to get into somebody's personal space. So it's something that he could easily write off. I think basically any suggestion that where she's kind of like blowing off the notion kind of goes away at the Riot House. And that was really kind of where I was going with that.
All right. Well, anyway, so let's talk about the untitled cut versus the theatrical cut. Now, some of this is there's more concert footage that's being shown. Mm-hmm. There's also a couple of scenes that are a little longer than there were in the theatrical version. My favorite example of that is after the show in Cleveland, while Dennis is giving his speech to the band, and while William recollects something Lester told him, is that how people like Dennis are ruining rock and roll as you know it. And then while Cat Stevens' The Wind plays, we see Penny dancing around in the amphitheater after everyone is gone amongst the debris and twirling around carrying a rose in her hand, you know, just soaking up the atmosphere of what's been left behind. And that's just a lovely little moment. And
it really is. It's a beautiful, it's not like even like, I was going to say it's a beautiful shot, but it's not. It's pretty standard. It's, you know, shot from above and kind of behind from the backstage area looking down on her. But it's just, you know, she's like just having her moment there. And it was just a great moment for her.
And then there are what I would say three crucial scenes that are in the untitled version, not in the theatrical version. The first is when they, along with the band, along with William and Penny, all go to a radio interview, which mm-hmm. is conducted by Kyle Gass, who is best known as being one half of Tenacious D with Jack Black. And Gass's character is clearly stoned out of his mind. And the band doesn't quite know what to make of him first, although he does ask a couple of normal questions, like, how did you guys meet? And Jeff says something very complimentary about Russell. And when the DJ is asleep, or so they think, certainly it looks like he's asleep, Russell starts to turn on Jeff, saying, "Why is it only at times like this that you say something nice about me?" And Jeff points out that, hey, it's not my job to be nice. And then things don't really descend into an argument, because Dick breaks the peace by saying a couple of things on the air that you're not supposed to say.
Oh, they all drop those F-bombs.
Yes. And then the DJ wakes up. And then the another major scene that we get is right when they throw a birthday party for Penny. This is when Penny learns that she's not going on the plane with the rest of the band, which is broken to her when Dennis says to her, sorry, there's not enough room on the plane. And again, like when William reveals that she was sold to Humble Pie for $50 and a case of beer, Kate Hudson plays very well the fact that she's devastated, but she doesn't want to let anyone know about it. So she puts on a smile and says, "Who else didn't get cake?" And that's a really good scene that I'm sorry that was left behind. And then there's one other scene that I'm blanking out on.
Well, I know the fight with the promoter goes on a little bit longer than it did previously.
Yes, but that's, as I said, that's a longer scene. And then we also get, another one, we get interview. This is a sequence rather than a scene. We get interviews with the band members, mostly Jeff Baby, while they're on the bus or standing outside the bus. Jeff actually does a lot of talking. The bass player, Larry, just says, when William says, "What do you add to the band?" And he says, "I'm the bass player." And Ed Valancourt, of course, doesn't say anything, which is why his line in the plane comes out when he's coming out resonates so strongly, because that's the only thing he says throughout the entire movie. But all of that, I think, adds to a richer experience. You know, I love the theatrical cut. I saw it twice in the theater. First time I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival, and I had to wait online for 4.5 hours to get a ticket to it. And then I saw it when it opened theatrically with a friend of mine. But as much as I love the theatrical cut, I think the untitled cut is a much richer experience. What do you think?
It absolutely is. And I think I was thinking about this like during the rewatch and seeing the, as you mentioned, the interviews with the other band members. And I think it also helped to underline, you know, the comments elsewhere in the film that Russell is kind of growing beyond the band because he's got this personality. He's got this level of talent. And, you know, while he's not necessarily acknowledging, you know, Jeff's similar level of talent, the fact is the bass player is pretty much interchangeable. He could be anybody. The drummer is pretty much anybody. You know, you could plug in session musicians and still have a pretty good band going on. And I think the fact that you've got this drummer who says pretty much zero, and this bass player who can't respond to the interview questions, it really does emphasize the fact that, you know, not just Russell, but Jeff, too, are really beyond these two guys.
And ironically, those are the two characters who are actually played by real musicians.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Billy Crudup, although he went to basically band camp that was run by Peter Frampton, who plays the manager for Humble Pie, he didn't actually play the guitar. And although when the band finds out that they're going to be on Rolling Stone's cover, when Jeff leads them into a spontaneous version, or leads them and everyone else who's there at the restaurant into a spontaneous version of Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show's, the cover of the Rolling Stone, that is the only time in the movie that we actually hear Jason Lee singing for himself.
Yeah.
Every other time he's dubbed by a person by the name of Marty Fredrickson. So, and you can tell that by the way he sounds much different to how Jason Lee sounds singing that song.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one major part of the movie that is played both for great comedy and great drama are all the phone call scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were, you know, when I saw this at the Toronto Film Festival, the phone call scenes got the biggest laughs, from the one that Elaine has with Sapphire. And by the way, that was originally supposed to be Estrella, but that part, for unclear reasons, got cut down, and so Sapphire got this bit instead. And it's really funny from when Elaine says to her, "Could you please tell him I know what's going on?" to Sapphire's defense of William, saying that, you know, he's doing really good, he's having a great time, he really respects women, and don't worry, he's still a virgin. And that's more than I've said to anything to my folks, so there you go. And then she pauses and says, "This is the maid speaking, by the way." And then when Ben calls after he's lost his virginity, Sapphire is the one answering the phone there.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "You know, you have a sexy voice, Ben Frank Torres." And then, of course, the great scene with Russell and Elaine. And one of the reasons why the scene works so well is that Frances McDormand and Billy Crudup were actually talking to each other on the phone. And also, this is not the usual, you know, as she says, Elaine is not the apron-wearing mother that everyone assumes she is. And she doesn't just yell at Russell, she admonishes him. Remember, she's a teacher.
Yeah.
So she's giving him a lesson then and there. And apparently that scene is based on quite a few conversations that rock stars have had in the past with Alice Marie Crowe. And actually, the first thing that Robert Plant said to Cameron Crowe when Crowe showed him and Jimmy Page the movie was, "Did your mom approve of this? Or did your mom like this?" Because, you know, he's still a little wary about her. But no, that scene plays beautifully. And on the more dramatic sides, of course, there's the scene where William is on the phone with Elaine and she talks about how much she misses him. And at the same time, Penny and Beth from Denver are there. And Beth is yelling about how his aura is purple. And that's a really powerful, fun scene. And then also the last scene between William and Lester on the phone, both of those scenes are, that scene is also very dramatic and very powerful.
Yeah, and I only had to wonder if the scene, because I knew that in the scene with Russell and Elaine, that they were in fact talking to one another on the phone. I kind of had to wonder if Frances McDormand was somehow within earshot, because you can also see in the background Kate Hudson trying to hold it together, you know, and she can't see the way Russell is reacting because he's got his back to her, but she is like trying so hard not to break that. She's got to be able to hear what McDormand is saying.
That's possible, although it may be the also the first time that she's ever heard Russell calling someone ma'am before. So that might be it. Now, let's get to the performances here.
Yeah.
Now, this was Patrick Fugit's first role, basically. He had done a stage production. And by the way, this was the reason, William's role was the reason, one of the main reasons why it took so long for Cameron Crowe to make this movie in the first place, because he was very hesitant about putting himself on screen like this. And Patrick Fugit didn't know anything about rock and roll. I think grew up as a Mormon. And as I said, he'd only been in one stage production when the casting director found him. And the casting director of this movie, by the way, was Gail Levin. And as Cameron Crowe has said in interviews, that he hates the fact that this is the movie on which Fugit lost his voice on, but he is really good in the movie, you know, showing someone who, on the one hand, because he's been given such a grounded education by Elaine, is somewhat smarter than his 15 years of age would suggest. But on the other hand, it demonstrates that he has quite a lot of growing up to do. And the fact that Crowe was able to shoot a lot of the movie in sequence, which doesn't normally happen, you know, that does help his coming of age story and Fugit's performance to come along here. Now, Billy Crudup and Kate Hudson were not the first choices for Russell and Penny. Brad Pitt was actually the first choice for Russell, and he actually worked with Crowe on the script for a while before deciding that he didn't get the part and backed out. And
that at least gives a little more credence to the Golden God line too, since Pitt is blonde.
Yes, and Sarah Polley was originally cast as Penny, but Polley is an actress who, while she may do the occasional genre piece, like she's been in a couple of horror movies, any other main street type of filmmaking, as far as acting goes, she's generally shied away from. And so she ended up turning this down. And actually, Kate Hudson was originally cast as Anita, but Pro gave the part of Penny to her because she had stuck with the movie for so long. She had gotten a couple of other opportunities in the meantime, but she turned them down simply because she wanted to do this. And while I and a number of other people have not been very big fans of most of what she's done since this movie came out, there's no denying that Kate Hudson is absolutely magical in this role.
That's a good word for it. She is just so amazing. And I was looking at IMDb, and there's an enormous list. It's got to be like 20, 25 names here of different actresses who auditioned for this role. And I'm looking at each one, I'm going, nope, 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 nope. Ah, that one might be interesting. Nope, 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 nope. You can't see anybody but Kate Hudson in this role.
Yeah, as much as I like Sarah Polley, I don't think she would have had... I mean, certainly she could have played the inner turmoil that goes on, but I don't know if she would have been able to play it as outwardly exuberant as Hudson does. And Billy Crudup, who looks a lot like Glenn Frey here.
Yeah.
And I think that was partly intentional. And Jason Lee are also very good in their roles. And also in the tension that lies between the two of them, even though there is maybe some underlying affection there, although you have to look really hard for it. But they're convincing as musicians, and they're convincing in the dramatic part too. And I want to mention Farrugia Balk real quick, because you could probably take her part out of the movie and it wouldn't affect the plot too much, but she lends an authenticity to the movie that you would have been missing if she wasn't there. And she not only plays the phone scene with Frances McDormand really great, as I mentioned before, but also in the scene near the end when she's chastising Russell and she delivers the line that's pretty much the thesis of the movie, when she says how, you know, she's disparaging the groupies that are in the cafeteria there eating the food, and she says about them, they don't even know what it's like to be a fan, to love some silly little piece of music or a band so much that it hurts. And that's what Cameron Crowe feels about music, and she doesn't make it feel like a thesis line, but she makes it come from the heart. And that's how I feel about music too, by the way. And then finally, among the performers, Frances McDormand we have to talk about. Ironically, of course, in real life, she's a huge rock and roll fan. As a matter of fact, her next major role after this, she played sort of a hedonistic middle-aged rock and roll fan in Laurel Canyon, which was directed by Lisa Chodolenko. But she's very convincing here as a teacher, as a person who is hard on their children but loves them deeply nevertheless. And you get all of that here. She's just so great.
Yeah, well, is there anything that she's not good in? But I especially was taken by the scene near the end where William comes back with his sister, and that could have been like some big, you know, swelling strings and, you know, big hugs and whatever else, and she underplays it so nicely that, you know, it I think it works better for me that way.
Ironically, that was the one part of the movie that was invented out of whole cloth, because at the time Cameron Crowe's mother and sister were still not getting along. It was only when the movie was about to be released that they finally reconciled. And you can spot Crowe's sister in the movie as well as his mother. His mother is there at the graduation scene when they're having William's high school graduation and he's not there. And his sister is in the elevator with the guy who is supposedly David Bowie, along with her real-life children. And finally, let's talk about the music. This movie is swamped with music, both in the theatrical cut and the untitled cut, and music lore of all kinds, including one brief bit I want to mention. When Penny is leading William through a hallway in the Riot House, they walk by a couple who are in the hotel room singing and playing guitar, and that's meant to be Graham Parsons and Emmy Lou Harris, who were involved personally and professionally at the time. But there are just so many songs and pieces of music that are being played throughout the movie, and not just the Zeppelin songs and Tiny Dancer, which is probably the most famous moment from the movie now, even though the cast did not like having to do it over and over again. It is a really powerful moment in the movie.
It is, and probably my favorite, but one of the best uses of diegetic music, because it starts out, you have no idea that it's diegetic music. It just seems to be like there on the soundtrack, and then all of a sudden, like little by little, you see the band members and the entourage starting to react to it. And I think the first thing you see is like a couple of nodding heads, and then the drummer actually starts drumming along with the record before people start singing. And it just works so, so well.
Yes. Now, one last thing I want to mention before we wrap this up, that on an interview with one of the anniversary editions on the DVD, Cameron Crowe has mentioned that even though William is in love with Penny, though she's in love with Russell, it's only when her plane is flying away and she turns towards the window, or she's in her seat and she realizes that she may love William back, and she turns towards the window as William is running by, and then you think that they might have a future together when they get back from Morocco. But Crow has said that in real life, he doesn't think that William would end up with Penny, that she's too much of a fantasy, that who he actually thinks he ends up with is Polexia. And if you had seen the theatrical cut only, you might wonder about that. But there is more of the scene in the room at the Riot House. There's more of a conversation between William and Polexia there. And then also when he's at the restaurant, which I think is called Max's Kansas City,
yes,
in New York City, in the untitled cut, Polexia actually says goodbye to him and kisses him, and then waves goodbye. And the wave, by the way, is what convinced Crow to cast Anna Paquin in the part. And so I think I can kind of see the two of them ending up together later in life, but I don't know.
I guess if he's going to wind up with anybody, but I always viewed this as, you know, this is kind of a one and done thing. He has his adventure, and he might see them again from time to time. And it's like, just, you know, hi, how you doing? And remember when? But I think I always viewed it as his time with these people is pretty much over.
Although when Rolling Stone did an article about the making of Almost Famous, apparently Penny Trumbull did visit the set one day. And according to Kate Hudson, Cameron Crowe pretty much turned into William Miller when they were together. And she said to him, you know, I'm so proud of you.
Nice.
Which is a nice little moment. Do you have anything to add before we wrap this up?
Just one other moment that I liked in the film, and it turned out to be one of those things where an actor was breaking character and they left it in, is near the beginning of the film when they are on the ramp and trying to get into the concert. And Penny tells William about her dream of going to Morocco, and she invites him along. Would you like to go? And he goes, yeah, yes, yes. And then he says, ask me again. And she asks him again, and he repeats his answer. And it turns out that was actually, you know, Fugit just like breaking character and looking to do another shot at the line. And it's one of those things that Crow liked and he left in the film.
Actually, it happens after the concert, though.
Oh, yes. You're right. You're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that's it for Almost Famous, except in the words of Elaine Miller, don't take drugs.
Yes.
Also, if
you're a fan of this film, you know, there are many, many different versions out there available. I mean, you can get your basic theatrical version on the DVD, and I know you're going to get into this later on, but you can get the untitled version. That's what the extended version is called, untitled. But, you know, as part of the 20th anniversary, not long ago, they released like lots of different additional versions with like extra music that kind of inspired the film but didn't necessarily make it into the film. And if you've got like $300, you're going to throw out the window anyway. There is a very limited edition. It's like 1500 units worldwide. I have no idea if they sold out. It's got like 5 CDs. It's got 7 LPs. It's got a 7-inch copy of Fever Dog performed by Stillwater. There's a photo book. There's a memoir. There's a prop replica of William's high school notebook. It's got stuff from like Rolling Stone, some replica ticket stubs, some backstage passes, a whole bunch of other stuff, and then also like photo prints of cast members, and it's just in this beautiful, beautiful package. So if you're a huge fan of the film, take a shot. It might still be available to you.
And the untitled version also has a hidden deleted scene where Penny says the name of Russell's girlfriend, Leslie, over and over and over again, which is an homage to Francois Truffaut's Stolen Kisses. And we'll leave it at that, except to say that in part two, we will be talking about 24-Hour Party People.
So stick around. That's coming up right away in your podcast feed.